Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, high school graduation rates have increased in the last decade, according to a new report. We'll tell you about that. We've also got Miami Valley Story Corps, Dayton Youth Radio, and some aviation commentary. That and more coming up on WISO Weekend. Up first, redlining is when banks in lots of U.S. cities refuse to make loans or provide services in some neighborhoods, often low-income black neighborhoods. The practice was officially ended in 1977 with a federal ban that also encourages banks to reinvest in poor areas. But now cities including Dayton are saying those regulations aren't doing enough. Dayton has joined New York, Seattle, and Cleveland by passing an ordinance to push banks to invest in low-income neighborhoods and avoid predatory lending. WISO's Lewis Wallace has more.
I'm in the car next to an overgrown park in Westwood on the west side of Dayton.
Find a bank.
I'm looking for the nearest bank branch.
Okay, here is what I found.
Siri can't find a bank nearby, and there's a reason. A PNC branch closed in this area in 2013, and now this is what's called a banking desert. Donna Preston, who's hanging out on a stoop nearby, confirms.
I'm not mobile. I don't have a vehicle, so it is kind of hard to get to banks.
And it makes things kind of tricky for her business.
I do hair for a living. I have a business called Donna Soft Touch Braids, so look me up. I'm on Craigslist.
She takes the bus to her credit union, but she runs the business mostly in cash. West Dayton is like a lot of areas around the country. It's seen bank branches pull up and leave if they were ever there in the first place. Kerry Gray is the Dayton City Commission's chief of staff. He says it can be hard for a city to convince banks to stick around.
It used to be the bank down at the corner was owned by the guy who lived on the next corner or the next block. But now they're owned by these big corporations that are based in cities outside this state, sometimes outside this country.
And Katie Crosby with Dayton's Human Relations Council says a lack of banks feeds into problems some neighborhoods already have.
The small business development is just not occurring. Economic development is just not occurring.
So Dayton's socially responsible banking ordinance is pretty simple. It tells the banks, if you want us to deposit city funds with you, then you'll have to show that you're investing in low-income neighborhoods. Rob Rowe doesn't like it.
Banks are not utilities.
He's with the American Bankers Association.
They're not charities. They're businesses, and they're created and established as business organizations.
Dayton will need to get people like Rob Rowe on board, though. The ordinance, like those in other cities, is really just evaluation guidelines, not actual regulations. Still, Jesse Vantal is hopeful. He's with the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. It wrote a template for these city ordinances.
It is a law that, you know, that over years and decades will make a difference. And I think you see that in the historic impact of a lack of investment.
He gives Ferguson, Missouri as an example of that lack. It was redlined. For decades, whole black neighborhoods were blocked from banking services like home loans.
The same is true with many neighborhoods in Baltimore.
Westwood, where the banking desert is, and most of the southwest side of Dayton were also historically discriminated against. The City Commission passed the ordinance with the leadership of Commissioner Dean Lovelace. It will go into effect May 22nd. Dayton currently does its banking with Fifth Third, which didn't respond to a request for comment. For WYSO, I'm Lewis Wallace.
A report released last week by the public policy group Civic Enterprises finds graduation rates in the U.S. have climbed over the last 10 years. The report is called Building a Grad Nation. Civic Enterprises CEO John Bridgeland is a former policy director for Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. He says his focus for the last 15 years has been high school graduation rates. On Saturday, Bridgeland was in Dayton to speak at the Grad Nation Summit in collaboration with Learn to Earn Dayton. I spoke with him by phone before his arrival. What were some of the reasons you found for the problem with graduation rates?
So young people said they didn't see a connection between what they were learning in school and what they wanted to be in life. They also thought that the expectations they had for themselves were often higher than the adults around them had for them. And they also wanted more support from caring adults and those in schools and in communities who could help them navigate what they saw as an increasingly complex world.
Do these responses, do they span across all ethnic backgrounds?
They do. We actually did interviews in 25 urban, suburban, and rural areas across the country. and across race, ethnicity, income levels, and disability. So we had a good cross sample of students across the country who had made this decision to drop out of school, and also had the benefit of hindsight and having to raise a family, working hard to get a job, and seeing the difficulties that dropping out of high school presented to them.
Tell us a little bit about building a Grad Nation, how you went about, a little more detail about how you went about compiling this information.
So four U.S. presidents have set a goal, a 90% high school graduation rate by a date certain, but there was never a plan to action to meet it or data to tell us where these students were and what schools. So data was marshaled to show that 50% of the nation's dropouts were found in just 15% of the country's schools, enabling a targeted response. And so we set this goal of a 90% high school graduation rate by the class of 2020, and for more than a decade now have put in place an evidence-based plan of those supports, reforms, interventions that are needed and that work to help keep young people on track to graduate. And as the nation's seen good progress, we're over the last decade, after 30 years of flatlining high school graduation rates, we've seen an 11 percentage point gain to the highest we've ever had in our history at 81.4%, which means that 1.8 million more students graduated from high school rather than dropping out over the last decade alone.
What were some specifics on those initiatives? Can you give me specific examples?
Yes, so we have actually in this year's report 124 school districts across the country who have made gains that triple the national average in terms of boosting high school graduation rates. Cincinnati had a 10 percentage point gain, Cleveland a 9 percentage point gain, Montgomery County a 5 percentage point increase. And we're seeing, obviously, every local community is embracing this problem in ways that address their own challenges. But we're seeing early warning systems that identify the attendance patterns, behavior, and course performance in reading and math for individual students, and then gets them the supports early and often to keep them on track, to stay in school, to perform in school. We're also seeing efforts in Cleveland that look at not just academic support, but social and emotional support, helping traumatized kids who are trapped in poverty or have other challenges in their homes and neighborhoods, so that the whole child is addressed in the school and not just the academic efforts.
With those advances in mind, where does Ohio stack up compared with the rest of the nation?
So Ohio is actually outpacing the national average by about a percentage point. It's at 82%, which is encouraging. And the Big Eight, as they're called, there have been increases across many of the Big Eight school districts in Ohio. I mentioned Cincinnati and Cleveland, and Montgomery County, the Dayton area. So that's all very encouraging. What's disturbing is the opportunity gaps that exist. If you're a white student in Ohio, 87% of you are graduating from high school. If you're African American or low income or Hispanic, your graduation rates are in the 60 percentiles, which means there's a 20 percentage point opportunity gap in terms of equal access to a quality education, and that's a disturbing gap that Ohio needs to address.
This report is just released, so what do you hope will happen from the information that's now available?
Well, I hope that, school districts and states will realize that this is not a chronically unfixable problem of poverty, or is not just the results of changes in demography or economic or social trends, but that the schools, the districts, the states that are really working the problem, they're getting good data on individual students, where they are in their trajectory of success in school or getting off track, putting in place these early warning systems, providing supports to teachers to strengthen their self-efficacy and ability to work with the whole child, academic, social, and emotional, and then ensuring that communities and parents and mentors and tutors are also part of the equation to make sure more students are successful, because schools recognize they cannot do it alone, and those schools and districts that are having more success recognize that they need significant supports from an array of partners in local communities. Cincinnati has a collective impact model called STRIVE. Cleveland has the Cleveland Plan that's been embraced by Governor Kasich and Mayor Jackson. Dayton and Montgomery County are making good progress in key areas and connecting student learning to career pathways. And all these things make a difference.
I've been speaking with John Bridgeland. He is the CEO of Civic Enterprises, a new report released by this group, Building a Grad Nation, Progress and Challenge in Ending the High School Dropout Epidemic, has just been released this week. John, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Sounds great. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. More on the other side of this break.
This week on American Roots, we're rocking and rolling. First with the girl group icon Lala Brooks of the Crystals. Then we'll take a sea cruise on over to Gretna, Louisiana, and visit with Frankie Ford. Plus a jukebox full of doo-wop and sock-hop hits. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Tune into American Roots Sunday nights at 6 on 91.3 WYSO.
WYSO reporters have been talking to all kinds of people about Latinos in education. Parents, students, teachers.
I mean, I have my butterfly wings that I wear to class sometimes.
Graduating Latino is coming back as an hour-long special. In case you missed it, this is your chance to meet the people we met and hear their stories.
Every time Javier fills out an application, he is asked for his Social Security number, and he doesn't have one.
That's this Sunday at 4 p.m. on WYSO.
This is WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. On Miami Valley StoryCorps, we bring you conversations between local people who went to the StoryCorps booth in Dayton last spring. Today, we hear from David Daly and his husband, Jim McCarthy. They talk about their relationship of nearly 20 years.
We went to Hawaii together.
We went to Hawaii with your parents.
Right.
And we had decided before we went to Hawaii to exchange rings. Back then, that was all we could do, basically. You could still have a marriage, but it didn't mean anything officially.
Right.
So we just had our own private ring exchange on a beach, Donkey Beach, which was known as a gay beach.
We waited intentionally until
sunset.
Yep. And I remember walking through the sugarcane fields, and there was really nobody around.
And then we exchanged our rings
and spent the early evening on the beach.
We never thought there would ever be a day when we could officially get legally married.
Yeah.
And so far, Ohio isn't recognizing it, but at least the federal government is. Fast forward to 2011, and we
two houses later.
Yeah, we've moved, got a dog. We decided to do something officially, so we chose to go to Washington, D.C.,
and get married. I don't know how to describe it. It just felt so special, and I hadn't expected that. And I remember feeling good until we got downstairs where we had to pay for the certificate.
Well, we got down to get the extra copies of the license, and
I looked down, and I didn't have my ring. And I was like, oh, God, where did it go? So we started back. I started backtracking my steps all the way up the steps in the elevator to the restroom on the fourth floor.
Digging in the trash can.
I'm pulling the trash liner out of the wall to look for my ring. Went all the way back to the chapel. Couldn't find it anywhere. And I had just resigned myself that I had lost my ring on my wedding day. And then I came back down where you were waiting there for the certificate and walked in the door. And it was glistening over in the corner. It had been in that same room the entire time. So. And then we were able to come back, and then we sent an announcement telling everybody what we had done and asking folks to recognize and appreciate and respect our relationship for what it was. And probably the most amazing response I think we just 3 years later got when we went to visit your Aunt Lois. And she's 88 now.
She has this whole rows. There must be 50, 60
at
books
least.
At least of photo books of photos and family history.
Mm-hmm.
And she has index cards, so you can look people up and know which album to pull out. And she goes, I want to show you boys something. And so she brings out an album, and she opens it up to a spread, and she goes, here, look at this. And we look down, and it's a whole spread of our wedding pictures.
Yep.
And our announcement that we had sent out.
She does all this scrapbooking, and so she'd add all this bric-a-brac around it and made it a really special layout for our thing.
So we all need some more Aunt Lois's in our life.
Yeah. I remember my mom giving me lots of – her big thing about me being gay was that she was afraid I was going to be alone. And I always joke and tell people that I think she likes me better now that I'm part of us instead of just me as a single guy. So, and I think it made it easier for her, and especially since they love you so much. Because we created memories with both our mom and dads, and that's, again, something that I wasn't ever sure I'd be able to do as a gay man.
Well, and us both having parents that are accepting of each other's spouse or husband makes it easier for our relationship, too.
Yeah.
Attitudes are changing in the U.S., but for our parents' generation, it's not everybody's changed yet.
Yeah.
So hopefully we'll have 18 more years.
At least, I think. 18 more
At
years.
At least.
That's right. So we're getting ready to go back to Hawaii this year for our anniversary.
And I was just looking up Donkey Beach today on the internet, whereas used to we had to walk down this little path, park on the road. Now there's a parking lot.
Yeah.
That was David Daly and his husband, Jim McCarthy. This Miami Valley StoryCorps interview and many others can be found at WYSO.org. Today's interview was edited by Community Voices producer and Antioch College student Ellie Burke. This week, we shared a powerful edition of WYSO's Dayton Youth Radio Project. It was from a teenager who grew up in foster care and shared some vivid memories of his experience. Here's Youth Radio Project coordinator Basim Blunt.
18-year-old Shakur Wortham told me his whole life was a lie because he grew up in foster care. He had a hard time building friends and making close relationships. So one day, we just went into the studio. We hit record, and I asked him some questions.
I first realized that I was a foster kid when, at the age of 6, I was at school, and I was trying to get on my regular bus that I used to go to or get on, and I tried to go home, you know. And then they called me down and told me that I wasn't going home. It was really traumatizing. I didn't know what to do. I was just stuck.
Just like that. This 6-year-old kid learned that he couldn't go home. He never saw his mom and dad again. And Shakur and his sister were sent to live with a foster family.
I lived with a nice little couple over like on the west side of Dayton. It was just me and my sister, you know. She used to have my back on like a lot of stuff, you know. In that foster home, she got taken away from me. When she got adopted, I felt like I'm losing my sister. And I started crying, and I felt so sad. I had a problem peeing in the bed, and I used to pee on myself, like, really frequently. And they would make me go in the basement, and they had this old-looking sink in the basement, and they would have me wash my underwear out. I mean, that would be the only home that I have probably gotten spanked at. I was hit with objects in a threatening manner. And that's when I went bad, you know. I started lying, stealing, and I'd even steal from the church that we went that, you know, I'd even steal from there.
Growing up, Shakur lived in several foster homes and said that some families didn't always follow the rules. And as a foster kid, neither did he.
I went to one foster home and it didn't last long because that's when my stealing habits became, that's when I started stealing a lot. I went into her friend's house and stole one of her friend's cell phones. Then I took it to school and I got caught. It got so bad to the point that I was just taking unnecessary things, like things that didn't even matter. Like, it was one time where I stole biscuits, like, just because. And I know it sounds funny, but I stole biscuits. After that, I stole some money, like at least like $40. And I hid it in the room that I slept in this cabinet. And that's where I hid the biscuits. And then they found the money, and then they found the biscuits, and then after that, they made me eat the biscuits raw. And if I didn't eat them, they were going to whip me. I got sent to a residential home. They had a gym there. You went to school on the computers there. It was two guys. One name was Zach, and he welcomed me there. And I felt, for like the one time in my life, I felt wanted. I viewed him as like a big brother. You don't always stay in a residential home. Like you also can get taken out and placed in another foster home. And it was like time for him to leave because, I mean, he left. And I felt like everybody always leaves me. And I fell into a deeper stage of like depression.
Things began to change when Shakur met a woman who ended up adopting him. She said it was their destiny and her faith that brought them together.
Out of all the kids she could have picked, why did she pick me? And she's a Christian. She felt like God told her, in a way I kind of do too, because one day she told me this story that she had a dream one time, and it was a dream of me, and I came running to her, and like as if somebody was chasing me, and I was like, help me. And then she started carrying me, and she's such a good mom. I can honestly say I love her and everything. Being in foster care, other people have it way harder. I'm kind of thankful that I had it the way I had it. After I graduate, I'll probably end up spending time exploring and finding something that I like to do, you know. Or I might just go on the radio.
Shakur stayed in the studio for 40 minutes. I walked back to check in on him, and he had left. I never saw him again. I found out later that Shakur had signed himself out of high school and moved cross-country with his girlfriend. He's been in contact with a few of his classmates, and he's doing fine. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Basim Blunt.
Funding for the Dayton Youth Radio Project comes from the Virginia Kettering Foundation, the Ohio Arts Council, and the Dayton Foundation. Last week, WISO's aviation commentators Paul Glenshaw and Dan Patterson teamed up to cover the World War II flyover in Washington, D.C., a parade of privately owned vintage warbirds celebrating the 70th anniversary of VE Day, the victory in Europe. Paul recorded voices and Dan took photographs to bring us this impression of the event. Here's Paul Glenshaw.
The flyover took place on a beautiful spring day. Ceremonies at the World War II Memorial preceded the flyover, which brought the airplane straight up the National Mall. The crowd was huge, with people of all ages and types mingling and waiting for the airplanes to arrive. There were plenty of aviation fans, from 2-year-old Hudson Shapiro.
What's on your tummy? Is that a B-29?
B-29.
Is that
Fifi? Fifi.
To retired Marine Mark Reagan, decked out in a vintage Marine uniform.
I am 100% World War II from the skivvies on out.
All right.
To Air Force Master Sergeant Danielle Harmon.
Oh my gosh, I'm probably going to be in tears. Those aircraft are the birth of my service. We've been around 68 years this September, and we've changed the face of warfare.
We met some folks from the Dayton area, too.
Rebecca Lundgren.
And Robert Lundgren. Being close to Dayton, Ohio, and Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, I've grown up going to that museum. So seeing all those planes sitting there on the ground and being able to see them today up in the air is going to be pretty cool.
I'm Dean Alexander. I'm the superintendent of Dayton Aviation Heritage National Historical Park in Dayton, Ohio. And so every airplane that flies today has a basic concept that originated in Dayton, Ohio.
There were also plenty of people there who experienced World War II firsthand. We met Ed Edelsack, sitting in a wheelchair in the shade and being attended to by younger Air Force personnel.
I was with the 11th Armored Division, part of Patton's 3rd Army, and fought in the Bulge. My field is physics, so I helped in building the bombs that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
We asked him if it was important for younger generations to understand World War II.
Absolutely important, right. That's why we're doing this. Wars never really solve any problems. They create other problems.
About 10 minutes after 12, the airplanes began to arrive. Everyone was on their feet. wave after wave came by, starting with small trainers, then proceeding through all the major phases of the war, from Pearl Harbor to Hiroshima. Then we met Bonnie Tyler standing alone at the base of the Washington Monument and scanning her airplane spotter guide. She was trying to figure out which one was her father's plane.
My dad is still alive at age 97. He flew a P-51 Mustang in the Battle of the Bulge, so that's what I'm looking for.
She actually remembered him coming home from the war.
And I can remember him coming into the bedroom, and he had his uniform on. And I said to him, with all respect, "You're awfully short." And of course, that's why he was a fighter pilot, because he was a small man.
She had never seen a P-51 fly. In a few minutes, a formation of four of them roared by.
Wow. It's really touching.
After the world's only flying B-29 rumbled by, the flyover's final act arrived. It was the missing man formation. Four fighters approached as taps sounded. The crowd got very quiet as one of the fighters pulled up and away, commemorating all those lost. With Dan Patterson, I'm Paul Glenshaw for WYSO.
You can see Dan Patterson's photos of the flyover in a video accompanied by Paul's audio at our website, WYSO.org. Aviation programming on WYSO is supported in part by the National Aviation Heritage Alliance and the Air Force Museum Foundation.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the fourth week of late spring. In the final week of the petal fall moon, in the fourth week of the sun in Taurus, in the 24th week of the new year in nature. When ragweed has grown 2 feet tall, and the cow vetch and yellow sweet clover and wild parsnips and poison hemlock and wild roses and blackberries are flowering, then locust blossoming season and mock orange blossoming season, iris blossoming season and rhododendron blossoming season and peony blossoming season, all those seasons sweeten the winds. And then the last leaves of the high canopy come out for summer. Strawberry ripening season complements the rhubarb of middle spring. Along the roadsides, find waving yellow meadow goat's beard and sweet clovers. Banks of silver olive shrubs spread their pollen. Buttercups overrun the wetlands. Tall meadow rue is knee-high now, pacing the fat angelica. Cedar waxwings migrate along the rivers. The first brown June bug clings to the screen door, and the first firefly glows in the lawn, and flea beetles come feeding in the vegetable garden. Pheasant, grouse, and turkey chicks appear along the fence rows. Half of the season's new ducklings and goslings swim the creeks. White-spotted skippers and red admiral butterflies visit the garden. Gold-collared blackflies swarm in the pastures. Leafhoppers look for corn. And scorpion flies hunt in the barnyard. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the final week of late spring. In the meantime, be on the lookout for young robins to be out of the nest. A sure sign of early summer to come.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org. A community service of Antioch College for the Miami Valley and beyond. I'm Jerry Kenney. We'll be back next week. Up next on WISO, The Book Nook.